We have more than 100,000 public schools across our nation, but these schools still are often divided along racial lines. Many neighborhoods remain segregated. Often families try to avoid their neighborhood school, not embrace it. Nicole Hannah-Jones thinks a lot about these problems. Her beat turned personal when she prepared to send her own daughter to school. She writes about racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. Her reporting on segregation in housing and schools has earned a Peabody and a Polk Award. Nicole Hannah-Jones, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So your body of reporting, your body of work, your actual beat really intersected in your life here in a deeply personal story that came out last June as you sent your daughter to school and you were exploring schools. Were you reluctant to really bring yourself into your reporting as you looked at schools?
Absolutely. I think in general, reporters should be telling other people's stories and not our own. And I've stood by that most of my career, but this was the school that I ended up enrolling my daughter in became a national story about school segregation, and it became very difficult for me not to write about it.
So you ended up sending your daughter to a neighborhood school. It is not affluent. It is not mostly white with fabulous technology and resources. It really, truly serves mostly poor children who are Black and Latino. You said this decision was very difficult for you and your husband because you could have made a different decision. Why did you decide to send her to this school?
So just to clarify, the school I sent my daughter to is a neighborhood school, but it's not in my neighborhood. But it is a 95% free and reduced lunch, more than 90% Black and Latino school. And it was a difficult decision because myself and my husband have the ability to either pay for private school or to access one of the more wealthy and integrated schools in New York City. But I have been covering school segregation since my very first job as a reporter in 2003, and just really felt that I could not at once be writing about how the individual choices of parents help keep segregation intact and then make a different choice for my own daughter.
Yeah, you even posed the question to your husband, are we experimenting with our child based on our idealism about public schools? Can you?
Well, that's the question that he posed to me.
Yeah, can you kind of fill that out for me? What was this debate going on about what public schools are and what they should be?
Right. So we both, like many, many parents and like most parents in this country, believe in public schools. We believe in the idea of sending children of different means and from different backgrounds into the same classrooms together. We're strong supporters of public schools and both products of public schools, and always assumed that we would send our own child to public schools. But then we moved to one of the most segregated school districts in the country, and suddenly we're faced with an educational landscape that had a small pockets of affluent, truly integrated schools and large numbers of very segregated schools. And I had decided in my head pretty early on that I was going to send my daughter to one of those schools, that I was not going to abandon the very children that I'd spent my career writing about.
Mm.
I had not told my husband that, though. So I kind of waited until the last possible time when in New York City, we have universal pre-K, and so you have a system where you can choose up to 5 schools, and you rank those schools, and then you're supposed to get into one of the schools that you chose. And that's when I told my husband that my intention was that we would get our daughter into one of our neighborhood schools and one of the high poverty segregated schools. He naturally, I think, balked at that idea and was very worried that as a Black family that our one generation out of poverty ourselves, who had worked very hard, who come from very working class households, who had worked hard to be able to offer our own child more than what we'd had, that this was not a decision that we should be making. And that's when he asked, you know, we do have these ideas about public schools, but are we actually experimenting on our child by putting her in a school that I had spent my career chronicling these types of schools and showing how they harm black children? So that was the discussions, many, many discussions that we had about this.
And when you visited
that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And when you visited these schools to check them out, what did you find? What did you see?
Well, so the difference between myself and my husband is I have been in schools for years. I mean, as a journalist, I've seen very high-functioning schools that are segregated, and I have seen many, many low-functioning schools that are segregated. But I think for my husband, you have all of these fears, and we've kind of been taught that you sum an entire school up by the test scores. And when he went in those schools, they were not what he expected. They, you know, the kids were happy to be there. There was good instruction happening in the schools. And it just wasn't the chaos that society tends to tell us happens in schools with low test scores.
We're talking with Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's an award-winning investigative reporter who covers civil rights and racial injustice for the New York Times. She's reported extensively on the ways segregation in housing and schools is maintained and what it looks like today. Nicole, what strikes me as curious about your situation is that you broke the cycle of busing. You were bused to another school as a child, a better school, an affluent where kids from, you know, were mostly white in Waterloo, Iowa, to get away from what you described as a chaotic neighborhood school. You know, you could have sent your own child to a school farther away from where you lived. How has that experience going to a school where you were bused to growing up impacted your decision today?
Well, I think that I may not be in the position where you would even be interviewing me had I not been part of a busing program that took me out of my segregated neighborhood schools and sent me to wealthy integrated schools. With that said, I come from a working class family where my parents' ability to get me out of those schools was the greatest gift that they could give to me. With my daughter is growing up in a very different world than I grew up in. My daughter's parents are professionals. I have a master's degree. I work at the New York Times. She's traveled all over the country. She goes to museums. So for me, there was not the sense of desperation that many black and Latino parents face, because I knew that anything that she would not get within the halls of the schoolway, or excuse me, of the schoolhouse, I would be able to give to her.
You could supplement.
I could supplement anything that she needed. And I think that is the difference between myself and many other black and Latino parents who are trapped in these schools. And that's kind of the message when I'm talking to white parents. So let me be clear. I don't think that the burden of integrating schools should be on middle-class black parents. I think that is fundamentally unfair. Middle-class black parents have not caused the segregation and are often one generation out of legalized segregation in this country ourselves. I mean, my father was born in Jim Crow, Mississippi. I think the obligation is on white parents. This was a personal choice that I made. But when I talk to white parents, this is what I tell them, is your fears are unfounded. Your children will actually do just fine. And that's what the data and the research shows, that white parents who go into these schools, it doesn't harm their children. It doesn't harm them academically. It doesn't harm them otherwise. But oftentimes, they are just too afraid to make that choice.
And Jason in Madison wonders, what benefits have you seen since you've made the choice to keep your daughter in the neighborhood?
Well, I think, one, my daughter is thriving. My daughter loves her school. She loves her classmates. And my daughter is experiencing the real world. I think that that is so important, that she not feel separate from people in her community who do not have the same access and same opportunities that she has, that she is learning that she's no better than them, that their families and their parents want the same things for them that, her father and I want for her. The kids in our classroom are smart. The kids in our classroom teach her things, and she teaches them things. And I think so much of this conversation is framed with the belief that somehow these children are less than our own children and that they have less to offer than our own children do. And we just haven't found that to be true. And this is kind of in the piece that ran in the New York Times Magazine asking, have we forgotten what the public in public education means? This is the heart of what I'm trying to get at, is when we say we believe in public schools, it's not in some elite institution that I can buy access to. It is this understanding that public schools are supposed to be about the common good, about building good citizens, about teaching our children about where they belong in the world and where they belong in relation to other people who may have more than them or who may have less than them. And I think we have come to think about public school as, how can I get the most advantage for my own child? The problem with that thinking is you cannot have an equal system but also have a system that advantages your own child. Those two things are in opposition. And I think what I'm trying to do with my work is help us get back to that original mission of public schools, where we are mixing all different types of people together, and we are doing this in the understanding that this is good for our entire society and not just what can I get for my own child.
Let's dig a little deeper for a moment into segregation, the roots of segregation. You assert that racial segregation, racial inequality were created with a ton of resources from the state, from the cities, from federal government, all the way down to individual pocketbooks. Are we seeing the same amount of resources to undo what has been done to separate people, separate kids based on their skin color and how much their families earn in integration?
I mean, clearly not. I think we kind of have this myth that segregation was a naturally occurring thing, and that to undo it, we have to do something that is unnatural. One of the things I hear a lot is that attempts to integrate housing and schools is social engineering, but that's denying the great, immense amount of social engineering that went into creating school segregation and housing segregation. I mean, what we forget is that the lead plaintiff in Brown v. Board of Education brings that lawsuit because she was being bussed away from her neighborhood school, which was a white school, to a black school that was further away. So we were fine with busing when busing was used for segregation. We were fine with a lot of school policies that cost more money, that were inefficient, that were inconvenient and harmful, as long as that inconvenience and harm and burden was placed on the backs of black children or for the benefit, or what we perceived as the benefit, of white children. What my work has shown is after Brown, we had a massive resistance in the South, and most of the North simply felt that Brown did not apply to them anyway. And we only had about 20 years of a real attempt at integration, and we gave up really fast because white Americans largely didn't want it. Where true integration efforts were happening, it wasn't just black children who were being bussed out of their neighborhoods, but white children as well. And what's also true is that in most communities, there was never busing for integration, but busing became kind of this red herring that could be used to bring down integration efforts in other places. So we've actually put very, very little effort in integration, and decades of actually centuries of effort into segregation. But that was because when we did that, it was benefiting white children. And efforts to even that out and provide quality integrated education for black children, we've done very little work on that.
And you said 1988 is when school integration kind of hit its peak effectiveness.
Yes. Well, not peak effect. I mean, that is when we peaked in terms of the number of black children attending school, white children.
Yeah, yeah. Why haven't we seen new landmark decisions from the courts to fight against segregated schools and the massive disparities we're seeing now?
I mean, what we know is we've had a re-embrace both legally and in terms of society overall, of Plessy versus Ferguson, of the separate but equal doctrine. So the Supreme Court has made it very, very difficult to get new court-ordered desegregation. Starting in the mid-1970s, when Richard Nixon is able to appoint four conservative justices to the Supreme Court, almost every ruling after that has been against expanding desegregation and making it more difficult to get desegregation. And that's been followed by a series of rulings in the 1990s that made it more difficult, and then the most recent ruling by the current Supreme Court in 2007, which struck down even voluntary integration plans in Seattle and in Louisville, Kentucky. So I think it's pretty clear that there is not a good avenue through the courts for desegregation. The place where there is some hope in the courts are through the state courts, because most states have a constitutional right to an equal education. And there is no constitutional right, a federal constitutional right to an education, but we are starting to see some state judges that are ruling for integration, particularly by social class.
We're talking with Nicole Hannah-Jones. She writes about racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. Her article titled "Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City" was published last summer. We have a link to the story on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. And we'd like to hear about your experiences in public school and whether racial divisions are evident in your local schools. Is there something being done about it? Do you see a disparity in resources? Add your voice to this discussion on public education at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. We're continuing our conversation now with Nicole Hannah-Jones. She sometimes calls her beat the segregation beat at the New York Times Magazine. Her reporting focus has been on the increasing reality of neighborhood and school segregation. Now, it's very hard to change these patterns of slipping back to racial divides in our communities. Her reporting became personal when she decided to send her daughter to the neighborhood school where they live in Brooklyn, which is predominantly low-income children who are Black and Latino. Join in the discussion on public education at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the most critical issues right now facing public schools? Did you decide to send your child to an underperforming neighborhood school? What was that decision like? Join in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. What is it about integration? You know, why can't there be some neighborhoods that just fall into white schools, some into Black schools, some that do have integration, that do seem to work really well? What is it about integration that is so important, Nicole?
Well, I think we should reverse that question and ask, what was it about segregation that was so important? Why did we create segregation and allow and legally mandate segregation for the majority of the history of this country? And the reason was all about resources. It was keeping and hoarding resources for white Americans, and it was keeping those resources away from Black Americans. And when you understand that history, that is why you had two systems of education in the South, despite that being extremely inefficient financially to have to have a Black school system and a white system. That is why we did that. That is why in the North, segregation was largely accomplished through housing. It was ensuring that resources could be directed to certain neighborhoods and away from certain neighborhoods. And neighborhood schools often reflect that intentional segregation for resources. So I think when we ask that question, if we understand why segregation was created, then we understand why integration is necessary. As I always say, integration for Black children and Latino children is not that they suddenly get smart when they sit next to white children. It is that never in the history of this country have Black children and brown children who are segregated away from white children gotten the same things that white children get. You can look at data coming out of the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, and it shows that you can predict how qualified the teachers will be, what the curriculum will be, what the facilities will be, how advanced the technology will be, by the race of the students in that school. And it doesn't matter what part of the country you're in, we have never broken that link between race and resources. So that is why, for black and brown children, getting into the same schools as white children is critical if they are ever to get the same education that white children get.
Let's take a caller now, Jennifer from Altadena, California. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What would you like to add?
I'd like to add that it's really important to utilize and send our children to that local public school. Communities are stronger when we utilize our public schools. Children walk to school. They see the children in their school at the local supermarket. Children naturally bind parents together. So it's important to do that. Now, I live in an area where there are tremendous amounts of private schools, and lots of people in upper socioeconomic groups are sending children to private without even thinking about public. And what I can see, I'm looking to send my child back into public school, the local school, because what I can see is that when those children go to the public school, they start to play together on their off time. And it's essential that we do this. And our country is much different than it was when I was going to school in the 1960s and the 1970s, although I went to an integrated public school, high school.
Nicole?
Yeah, I think the caller is absolutely right. I think that integration is critical for the fiber of our communities. It makes our communities healthy. Anyone can look at a highly segregated city and see how that impacts the entire city, that there are certain sectors of the city that people don't go to. There are certain schools that people who have choice would not enroll their children in. And that does tear at the fabric of an entire community. What we also know is we do talk a lot about the benefits of integration for black children, but there are also benefits for white children. And one of the key benefits is white children who go to integrated schools grow up to be adults who live in integrated neighborhoods themselves, who are more likely to work in integrated workplaces and to send their own children to integrated schools, because it is getting to know people across racial lines that helps one understand that people really are not that different. When you only have to come in contact with people over there, you only see people, black folks on TV when they've been accused of committing a crime, even if you are a liberal person, you're going to have these racial biases. So I think that that's critical. And I think we know that colleges understand that if you want people who are going to be able to be innovative, who are going to be able to solve the problems of the future, you can't have everyone who has the same experiences and who thinks exactly alike. Having a diverse set of kids in a classroom actually makes everyone smarter.
You write that New York City public schools are among the most segregated in the country. Black and Latino children have become increasingly isolated, with 85% of black students and 75% of Latino students attending intensely segregated schools. Is that typical around the country, are you seeing?
It is typical in northern and Midwestern cities. So we've tended for a long time to think that the South is the place with the race problem. But the South actually has the most integrated schools in the country, largely because the South was forced to integrate over court orders, and many northern cities were able to avoid that. So yes, black children remain the most segregated group of children in this country, and particularly, like I said, we can think of cities, Philadelphia, Chicago, Milwaukee, New York City, and know that all of those schools are highly segregated. And what's interesting is it's not just a numbers game. It is particular to black children. So in New York City, Latino children are actually the largest ethnic group, but black children are more segregated than they are.
Something I took away from your piece is that a good principal can be a game changer. Tell us about PS307's Roberta Davenport and how her energy transformed the school so that it was something families really were attracted to.
So this question always... I'm going to answer your question, but then I'm going to give some caveats.
Yeah, so, sure. Go ahead.
Yes, we know that leadership at an individual school is critical. It is critical no matter what the school is, but it's particularly critical at a high poverty school where parents do not have a lot of resources and where the school often struggles to get a lot of resources. So I've spent enough time in schools to know that the difference between a failing high poverty school and one that can be seen as successful is almost always the principal. And parents understand this, too. When parents go into school, they know that leadership matters. And when we went to visit PS 307, the principal there was a longtime principal who had actually lived in the housing projects that served the school as a child. So she understood that these children could achieve and could be anything that they wanted if they were given the resources and if they were treated as if they could succeed. So she ran a school that was nurturing, that focused on the whole child, which can be, you know, very different. A lot of times segregated schools become punitive. They become all about testing and all of those things that middle-class parents want for their children you often don't have. She was fabulous at raising outside money. Our PTA could only raise a couple thousand dollars a year. It's a very poor school. And, you know, a mile down the street, there's a PTA that could raise sometimes almost $1 million. She was able to get outside funding to put a Mandarin program in the school to ensure that they had a music program and a STEM magnet program. So it was wonderful in that way. The problem is that is not systemic. You cannot ensure quality education for students based on one charismatic leader who typically at these high poverty schools burns out from the long hours and the tremendous amount of work that it takes. And that's not systemic. You're not going to have that across all schools. So I think we tend to point out to these exceptional schools because it lets us off the hook for actually not creating schools where 90% of kids are impoverished, where you don't have to have a heroic educator just to get a quality education for black and brown children. And that's my problem. So on the one hand, I think it is important for parents to understand that you can put your kids in a high poverty school and they can absolutely get a good education, but that is not the norm for most children in these schools.
We're talking with New York Times Magazine investigative reporter Nicole Hannah-Jones. She covers racial injustice, and she writes a lot about how neighborhoods and schools are increasingly becoming divided along racial lines. You can add your voice to this conversation about public education at 800-642-1234. You can share your experiences, how public schools changed you, or what choices you made for your own children at 800-642-1234. You can post to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's now go to Shauna in Hayward. Hi, Shauna.
Hi there. I was calling because I'm really interested in this conversation and sort of the difference that it sounds like you're discussing. Well, I'd like you to expand on the difference between integration related to skin color specifically, and then integration related to financial resources, because it sounds, if I'm understanding the situation correctly, it sounds like your guess integration is more based upon financial resources than skin color. So if you could expand on that, I will hang up and listen to your response on the radio.
Yeah, that's a good question. So here's what I would say to that is I am still talking largely about racial integration, and there's a couple of reasons for that. Census data shows that if you're poor and white, you actually are most likely to live in a middle-class neighborhood. So poverty for white people is manifesting in a very different way. Typically, of course, there are exceptions, but the typical poor white American is not being isolated away from opportunity. They are living in opportunity-rich neighborhoods. And actually, what the census data shows is that a poor white American is more likely to live in a middle-class neighborhood than an affluent black American. So black Americans, even if they are able to get and higher income, are still often trapped in segregated neighborhoods, in segregated poor neighborhoods, and in segregated schools. So simply integrating by socioeconomic status is not going to get at the problem. There are millions of poor white children in these schools. If schools were simply segregated by poverty across the country, those schools would be integrated racially, but they're not. So I think that is why racial integration is so important. Now, integration across social classes is also critical, and poor white children certainly should not be concentrated in high poverty schools either, but that's just not typically the case. You're finding that black children are segregated regardless of their income.
Shauna, thank you so much for your question, your call. Let's go to Leela now in Milwaukee. Hi, Leela.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, fabulous. So one of your previous callers had mentioned children attending their neighborhood schools as it being so strong for the community to have neighborhood children going to the same schools, which is part of the reason I decided to send my daughter to our local neighborhood schools for elementary school as well as her middle and high school, along with the fact that she can walk to school. It's only two or three blocks away from our home. So, number one, she's getting some exercise. And number two, we are not contributing to all of the busing by putting her on a bus and having her travel for 2 to 3 hours just to get to school both ways, which obviously hinders morning commute with all the school buses everywhere, contributing to more carbon pollution, et cetera. My comment to Nicole is I keep hearing her talking about black and brown children. I'm wondering where the red and yellow children fall in her equations.
So, good question. I think I've covered education in cities where there's very, very small indigenous population, so I don't tend to speak about them, but they certainly, they are also segregated, and their statistics very closely mirror black students. As far as Asian students are interesting. As I'm sure your listener is aware, Asian students, or maybe not, maybe she's not aware, but Asian students are of racial minorities the most integrated of all students, both in terms of housing and schools. So they are not dealing typically with concentrated poverty. They are not dealing with racial isolation, and they are not being isolated away from opportunity in schools or neighborhoods. So that's why I don't tend to speak about them, because I'm speaking about children who are being deprived of quality education, and the typical Asian American student is not. Now, that also depends on where, how that student got here. Students who are children of immigrants who have come either on education visa or on a work visa are doing very well. Asian students who have come here as refugees, their numbers actually, they're more segregated, they're more likely to be in high poverty schools, and their numbers tend to mirror those of black and Latinos. I also just wanted to say something quickly about neighborhood schools. I'm not valorizing neighborhood schools. I think neighborhood schools in integrated neighborhoods or in transitioning neighborhoods or in gentrifying neighborhoods can be a force for integration. But we also know that neighborhood schools in highly segregated residential communities can be a force for segregation. And so what I have found is that white parents in segregated white neighborhoods want very much neighborhood schools. White parents who are living either in integrated neighborhoods or are living in close proximity to black neighborhoods want quote-unquote school choice. They want to be able to send their children away from their neighborhood schools if their neighborhood schools have a lot of black kids in them. So I don't think, I think if people had their choice, most Americans would choose a school that is close to home. But black parents, just like white parents, the thing that they want most is a quality education. And unfortunately, in this country, because we have this history of forced segregation in housing and in schools, oftentimes to get integration, we have to give up on this notion of neighborhood schools.
Well, Leela,
That's why I point to the Brown v. Board case. Kids have always ridden buses. Matter of fact, kids rode wagons before they rode buses. Busing has been a part of the educational landscape ever since there was such a thing as a bus. That is why the yellow school bus is one of the most iconic images of schools. Our reaction to busing is a distinctly racialized reaction. We did not have a problem with busing in this country until we began busing for integration. even though most communities never bust for integration.
Well, Lila, thank you so much for your comments and question. We're talking with journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. She is a writer for New York Times Magazine covering racial injustice. There are more than 49.5 million public school students in this country, 3.1 million teachers. Certainly a lot at stake in how public institutions operate. When we come back after a short break, we'll take a look at where public education is headed under the leadership of Betsy DeVos, a Secretary of Education, and we'll welcome more of your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on public schools on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today, and this is the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation right now with journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. She covers racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. She previously reported for ProPublica. For several years now, she's been writing about why schools continue to divide along racial and economic lines and the problems that occur from that slip back to segregation. She's writing a book about segregation. You can join in with your thoughts and experiences about public education at 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can send us an email at talk@WPR.org. Nicole, let's turn to discussing the future of education under the new Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos. And let's first hear a bit from her speech at CPAC last week, the Conservative Political Action Conference.
This is not a left or a right issue. This is an American issue. We need education to work for every child. So let me ask you, do you believe parents should be able to choose the best school for their child regardless of their zip code or family income?
Yeah.
Me too, and so does President Trump. We have a unique window of opportunity to make school choice a reality for millions of families. Both the president and I believe that providing an equal opportunity for a quality education is an imperative that all students deserve.
So school choice, charter schools, how is this impacting public education now, and what do you see coming down the pipeline?
So I think when you hear Betsy DeVos say that, that is such a powerful message. That is a message that sounds good to every American, is that your zip code should not trap you, that you should be able to choose a school for your child and have the same choices that wealthy parents have. The problem is, it just has never worked out that way. So I think what we need to understand is school choice policies tend to crop up in diverse and highly segregated communities, and they have not been shown overall to advantage black and brown children and low-income children, that the people who are best able to take advantage of school choice policies are white and middle-class parents. New York City has entire choice starting in middle school to high school. But if you look at the most prominent schools, you look at the schools with the best curriculum and the best teachers, they have screens, they have ways of weeding out your average parent, and those schools are disproportionately white and disproportionately Asian. So it is a message that is salient, and it's a message that sticks with people, but it is just not the reality. One can look at the city of Detroit, where half of schools are charter schools, and it's very clear that simply having choice has not meant that black and brown parents have good choice. They are not able to choose into highly functioning schools. They are often going from a failing traditional public school to a failing charter school. So I think we have to push back against the allure that choice fixes everything. Public institutions, even when they fail, we know what their mission is, and their mission is to provide quality and justice for all people, regardless of where they come from. The market has a completely different mission. The market's mission is profit. The market's mission is not to care for individuals and to care for society. It is to make money. And I think that we have we've come to think about public schools as just another market force, and that public schools should be operated as a business, but that is not what public schools are supposed to do. So, yes, choice sounds great, but I think we need to understand that for many, many parents, and the parents who need choice the most, they have bad choice, and they're often not able to exercise that choice for the benefit of their children. So what's more important is to create public schools where one does not have to shop around and try to find an advantage, because those schools are functioning well for all the children.
Let's take another caller now, Eric from Nina. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how are you both doing?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, I would like to ask, what about addressing the social or rather cultural barrier that would be the discomfort black and brown Americans feel when they enter a predominantly white school or community when it comes to, be it housing or, in your case, education?
So I write about this a bit in the piece I wrote about choosing a school for my daughter. And no, it was not easy to leave my community, ride a bus an hour away to an nearly all white school that was very wealthy. But I think what is clear is for black students, for brown students, there will be a struggle. It's which one. Would it have been better for me to be in my community and have schools that didn't educate me, or to be uncomfortable and have to go to schools that, frankly, we are in a majority white country, where if I were to be successful in life, I was going to have to learn to navigate white spaces regardless. But I also think that what's important then is understanding the difference between desegregation and integration. What I went to was a desegregated school. It was a school with a handful of black kids, so it was no longer a majority white school. An integrated school would have been much more reflective of my town, which was about 15% black, which would have meant there was at least a reasonable number of black kids in my school. I would not have felt so alone. So what I'm talking about is true integration, where communities, schools are reflecting the populations of communities. What we find is, black people, when they're polled, they do not mind being in heavily white settings, but they don't want to be in almost entirely white settings. They want to be in settings where there is a substantial black population, but you cannot grow up in this country as a black person and not learn how to be in spaces where you will be in the minority. So I think it's more about true integration, something that is equitable, not simply a handful of black or brown kids in a white school, or a handful of black or brown families in a white neighborhood.
Eric, thanks so much for your call. Let's now go to Angela in Milwaukee. Hi, Angela.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really love hearing these conversations. It gives me hope for the future of public education. I agree with your guest and think it's very important for our democracy that we keep those institutions going. And I just wanted to make a comment about the fact that I grew up in Milwaukee here. I moved from a white rural setting my entire life to what we call Bayview in Milwaukee in the 80s when integration, like, you know, busing just started taking place. And it was a very tense time, and it was scary for everybody because nobody, you know, especially the kids, didn't really know what to expect. They were seeing, you know, changes in their neighborhood that they have never experienced before, and this fear for them was sometimes quite ugly. So I grew up in high school with that experience. And my children, I was able to give them through an arts integrated curriculum just north of downtown Milwaukee. My offspring grew up in a truly integrated school. So to them, now that things are in Milwaukee are more segregated and starting to go back the opposite way, it's very interesting because my my now adult children who went to school in the 90s to a truly integrated school, they can't understand what's happening here, and they are very sad about the way that things are going in our city. And if I could also comment on the fact that this school choice that we have in our state is a huge mess, and it's really a problem because families who live in poverty. I was I'm white, but I lived in poverty with my children as a single mother, and you know, you have to make choices that are the best for you and your family. However, it's very important to keep in mind citizenship, what's best for the entire group. And unfortunately, when you go with a business that is masquerading as a school, your choices are taken away and people who are disadvantaged are left behind. And unfortunately, I think during the current administration, that's the way it might go.
And Nicole, several things to unpack there in Angela's comments. What would you like to look at?
You know, I grew up, so I was in middle school at the peak of integration, and even at the peak, most black children in this country were not attending school with white children. They were not attending integrated schools. But we were that generation that actually did experience pretty wide-scale desegregation. And I think I hear all the time from parents who hoped to enroll their children in a school that looked like the school that they went to as children, and that has become increasingly difficult as schools have resegregated. What I say about New York is that when you have a system that becomes so desperately unequal, it becomes very, very challenging to then integrate that school, because you're not asking wealthy and white parents to go into a school that's 60% black and Latino or 60% poor. You're asking them to go into a school where nearly every kid is poor. And this is, again, why choice doesn't work, because what then happens is people who have choice avoid those schools, and the children who are left are the children who don't have choice. So I think we are dealing, we're dealing with our decision to walk away from efforts to integrate, and it was hard. It was challenging. Some places it was violently resisted. Many places white parents simply fled the public schools, or they moved across the city line to a white suburb. This was never going to be easy, because we were trying to undo an educational system built on racial caste, and also to take away some sense of privilege from parents who had always enjoyed that. So it was going to be very tough, but when we really tried, it was working. And now we're dealing with the consequences, where parents who would like to choose an integrated setting for their children find it very difficult to do so.
And Nicole, in the little time we have left together, are there any pockets of change? Are there any places in America that you see are bucking this trend of slipping backward toward resegregation?
Not many. Whenever I'm done with the interview or giving a speech, people always want me to wrap it up with some sense of hope. Unfortunately, I don't feel a lot of it. There have been places that have refused to give up on this, and are now really being tested. I mean, Wake County, North Carolina, was a place that has long been held up as a model. They implemented very early on, you know, decades ago, a system of busing and magnet schools, and where they were constantly balancing out schools to make sure that they did not become too heavily black and Latino or too heavily poor. And because of that, they were really able to keep the white population and keep a very high quality education for a lot of kids. Unfortunately, the growth of that region, partly due to the quality schools, has made that very difficult to keep going as the city becomes more and more sprawled out and busing gets longer. And you had a large number of white people moving down from the north who are not used to not being able to buy into segregated white schools. And so that coalition in Wake County has kind of fallen apart. Similar in Louisville, that was a Supreme Court case that I referenced earlier. That was a community that had been ordered by the courts to integrate, had been released from that court order, and decided the integration was good for their community and they were going to keep doing it. The Supreme Court struck it down. Remarkably, the community kind of defied that and continued to try to integrate the schools, but now the state legislature has passed or is passing a law that will force that city to zone kids to their neighborhood schools. And in a segregated city, neighborhood schools mean segregated schools. So I think even where we have had communities that have really wanted to work on that, the will to keep doing that work has been hard to maintain.
Nicole, thanks for spending time with us on this issue.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Hannah-Jones covers racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine. Her article titled "Choosing a School for My Daughter in a Segregated City" is linked on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Thanks to producer Scotty Myers with on-air production help from Jason Butler today and technical direction from Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, filling in for a vacationing Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Hope you can stick around.